friends are gone and my hair is gray. I ache in the places where I used to play, and I'm crazy for love, but I'm not coming home. I'm just paying my rent every day in the Tower of Song.
Welcome to Radical Australia on Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. This program is podcast. You can access the podcast later on. Empress Dale Bridge, how art thou?
Very well, thank you. How are you, Joe?
You're looking exceptionally well today. Sometimes I look at you and I think, will she make the whole program? Will she collapse? Will I have to do mouth to mouth?
Not today.
Now you're looking really healthy for a change. Yeah. You should see that. Our special guest, he's only got to answer two questions, is Lance Collins. Good afternoon, Lance.
Good afternoon. Yeah.
Relax, Lance. It's easy. There's only two questions. You've got 55 minutes to answer it. I'm sure you've never been in an exam where you've had 55 minutes to answer two questions. Now, the first question is very simple. What year were you born?
1955.
55. So you're actually a bit younger than me and a bit older than Dale. And the second question, we've got 54 minutes to answer. What's the first thing you remember about being on planet Earth? What's the first thing that comes into your mind?
The first thing?
Yep.
Interesting question, because some people can insert memories into your head, but the first one that's bona fide was I was 3 or 4.
Yep.
And my father worked on a trotting stud in the Wimmera, right, of Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a grey Arab mare, a double grey Arab mare that was his stock horse.
Right.
And I was fascinated with this horse, and he had her tied up in a yard while he had lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And I wandered down and climbed up there somehow.
Right, on the horse.
On the horse.
Right. How many hands would it have been?
14-2.
Oh.
And so I got the reins undone, and I was, so being a hot-blooded Arab mare, she thought, well, you know, this kid wants me to go, so she went. And I've got this vague, in awful clarity memory of belting around this this stockyard at a million miles an hour on this Arab mare that was made out of pure fire, and not knowing how to
stop.
So I did what any enterprising 3 or 4 year old would do. I started screaming, which just made her go faster. Anyway, the old man rescued me, and that was.
Did he do the usual thing that old men used to do in those days when they rescued their kids? Then he got angry at you?
Oh, no.
No.
Unless I blanked that bit out, but no, I don't remember it.
So what was life like for a young boy on the Wimmera?
Hot or muddy?
Hot or muddy?
Yeah, it was sheep and wheat country. And the place was a trotting stud, so there were big log stables there with all the trotters in them. I've got memories of all the men being down there one night because one horse had kicked a hole in the wire mesh fence, and there was sort of blood everywhere and people running around with towels and things. So, vivid impressions.
Did you have got any brothers and sisters?
A sister and two brothers. The two brothers are about 10 years younger.
10 years younger.
And the sister's 18 months younger than me.
So you're the eldest, right.
Parents weren't quick enough to break the model. Yeah.
Well, in those days, you know, contraception was a hit and miss affair. You know, things have changed, but in those Ballarat East for a 3-day celebration. Oh, yeah, and there's these wonderful pictures of these old blokes, you know, big beards, you know, sitting there, no smile on their face in 1904. Yeah, and because it was more radical, but it was a tougher place, Ballarat East. It was.
It was. Yes. Yeah.
So, did you survive to year 12?
I did.
Yeah, how'd you go?
Oh, scraped through, you know, social scene, that sort of
right. Anything in particular stick in your mind about schooling there?
No. I remember way back in my primary school years, one of the old farmer locals telling me, oh, you know, enjoy your time at school, they're the best years of your life.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a vague suspicion I was being fiddled.
and
experiences sort of verified that for me.
Well, that's right. So what did you do after year 12? What were you, 16, 17?
Yeah, I was 17. Oh. And by that stage, my parents had divorced and was living at Gravedale in Geelong.
So you're living with your mum or dad or?
Mother, yeah.
With your mum in Gravedale, yeah.
So
Groveldale, we call it.
Groveldale. So where were you living at the time?
Oh, no, I've got a good friend who lives in Warrnambool. He used to teach at Grovedale High School in the, must have been the early 80s, and he called it, they used to call it Groveldale.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Now I've lost the one listener in Grovedale.
Yeah.
One, not more than one. So what did you do? 17? You're living at Grovedale?
Yeah.
You didn't go surfing or something?
No, my two younger brothers, they became... They became surfers and other interesting exploits, which I've better not dwelt with here. But I just survived at year, did year 12 on matriculation as it was then.
Right.
And then got the blazers out and I was offered a spot at La Trobe University.
Right.
So I started doing sociology.
So did you move down to Melbourne, I see?
Yeah, that's right. The next year, lived in college, but... Yeah. I lasted about 3 months there and thought, I've had enough of this.
What year was this?
1972. I finished matric, so then started at uni in 73.
73 is a great year. I was actually La Trobe. I came down from Queensland to kind of a squat in the digs there, in the student digs with some of the old Maoists or socialists or something. I remember that. I was 19 or 20 when I came down.
Oh, right.
This year I was born.
What?
73.
73? I thought it was 63. Yeah. 73.
It was an interesting year, I remember.
It was,
there were a lot of young blokes there who had just been demobbed from the army and got us out of Vietnam and ended conscription and everything. They all showed up wearing their green shirts and things like that. But no, it was good, but I decided I'd had enough of the study malarkey, so I withdrew and ended up in West Queensland.
What,
on the cattle camps.
Cattle camps. That'd be hot and dry work.
Yeah. Yes, that was another school of higher education too.
Yeah, would have been, What'd you pay? Like $26 a week plus food would be about right in those days?
Yeah, they paid you for, and it was very low wages,
yeah.
But they paid you for an 8-hour week plus 4 hours on Saturday.
Yeah.
The reality was you worked dawn till dusk 24-7.
Seven, that's right, yeah.
So... agricultural exploitation was alive and well.
That's a Rockhampton girl, though.
Oh, okay.
So we don't want to hear about any exploits in Rockhampton, Lance.
Oh, it's just hot up there, yeah? But you're out west. Hot and dry.
And cold, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, desert-like.
Gets to below freezing at the moment.
Out near the gem fields and the willows and stuff.
That's right.
Yeah, my dad's up there at the moment. Oh, it's a shocking place.
Dust, flies,
that's it.
Dead cows.
Yeah. It was a good experience to have because you fly over Australia now and it sort of very quickly turns brown as you see it leave the narrow coastal strip. But when you look down at it, it looks like there's nothing there. But in fact, there's quite a lot there once you sort of get in amongst it.
Yeah. So how long did you last there?
I moved around a bit breaking horses and things, but the longest place was 6 months on Bulloo Downs, which was an old Kidman Reed property out of Thargaminda.
Mm. How do you break horses? How did you do it?
Some people talk about a system, but because all horses are different, then you don't break any two in the same. But there's no thrashing.
Are there any general principles that you...
Yes, the way I did it was pretty much the way my father had done it. If it works, you know. Why break it? But no, there's a lot of driving them around, getting them quiet and accustomed to you first and then used to sudden noises and things like bags and plastic bags these days. And then you teach them, you put what's called mouthing gear on, so it's a pair of long reins and a bridle.
Mm-hmm.
I used a headstall before I put a bit in their mouth so they got the idea and learned the commands before they actually had a bit in their mouth. And then you just drive them around so they learn to stop and turn and back up and all that sort of stuff.
These are wild horses they catch out.
Sort of a bit closer to home.
Right.
But the same principles apply. And when they're ready, you think they're ready, then you get on and hope they don't buck you off. So.
You haven't done camels, have you?
No.
No, I'm just interested because you would have seen them around there.
Yeah. Oh, they were... No, I didn't see camels out there. Did muster up a lone donkey once with this big mob of cattle, and the manager's son wanted to take it back to the homestead for some reason. So, there was a terrible trip because this donkey would walk up the middle of the mob because it was afraid of nothing, and you know, 2,000 cattle head one way and another 2,000 head the other way. And all the horses sort of didn't like it, so it was a long trip back to...
So how long did you last in this type of itinerant work?
I was away 2 years and then I went back to university. That had always been my plan. I just needed to let off some steam.
Right, right. You needed to be broken just like the horses.
That's right.
So back to La Trobe or somewhere else?
Back to La Trobe.
What, you didn't take up the sociology course again?
I did, yeah. It was a mixture of history, sociology and philosophy, which I struggled with at the time, but in retrospect it was... very interesting and relevant, and you know, we did stuff like logic, you know, what a logical deductive argument is, and by the end of my time in the army, many years later, I was working out that there wasn't much logical about what happened in the army.
Now, so there's orders. So, army, you just mentioned the army. What happened after you got your degree? You did get your degree, hopefully.
I did, yes. Yeah. I did.
Good.
Oh, it had been a long-term plan of mine to join the army.
Mm-hmm. Any particular reason why? I mean, you're telling me your parents were against the Vietnam War.
Oh, too many of those 1960s movies, I suppose. But right. But there's two reasons, and one is the official one, which is what I told the army, which was I wanted a challenging, stimulating outdoor career.
Right.
Which they believed, and the other one, which is the truth, was a well-meaning but misguided uncle gave me a box of soldiers when I was seven and I hadn't put them back in the box by then, so
right.
off I went.
So where did you join?
I joined in Victoria. Mm-hmm. I did the officer training course at Portsea when there was still a cadet school there.
Mm-hmm. What was that, 3 years or
no? No, that was 1 year.
Just 1 year?
Yeah, and the deal was if you had a civilian degree, you graduated as a lieutenant.
Right.
And if you didn't have a degree, you'd just done their 12-month course and you graduated as a second lieutenant and had to do a few years in that rank before going up to lieutenant.
So how old were you when you graduated as a lieutenant?
I was a grandfatherly 25, I think.
25?
Yeah, so 25. I left it until the last moment before I went in. And most of the other people there were 18, 19, 20.
18, 19, right. So where was your first... What happened after you graduated? Where did they send you?
I was posted to the Intelligence Corps...
Why the Intelligence Corps? Well, I think you're a bright young
man. I expressed an interest in it and I could spell current affairs.
That's right. So what year was this?
That was 1980.
1980.
But in those days you had to do a couple of years in what they call one of the arms, you know, the combat corps first, which I think was a good idea. So I ended up with the 2nd, 4th Infantry Battalion in Townsville as a rifle platoon commander.
Mm-hmm. What was that like?
That was great.
Why?
Oh, it was a challenging outdoor career I'd been seeking. You know, so.
Marching people around in a circle.
Oh, no, we spent a lot of time in the bush. That was the this was about the time Canberra formed what they call the Operational Deployment Force.
Right.
Remembering the invasion of Timor had been 5 years earlier.
Right.
And I think some of the wise heads had decided we didn't have anything to go in a real hurry anywhere, so... they formed this thing.
So you're actually doing out in the bush?
A lot of the time.
Self-sufficient or?
Oh, no, there's the usual logistic train back to, but, you know, you started off with 7 days rations and as much water as you can carry. And I do have memories of trudging up the side of High Range and, you know, stifling tropical heat with a sort of full load of rations and as much water as you could carry in. And I'm not into the zodiac, but I do know my star sign is Aquarius, and I remember thinking this carry about 10 litres of water. This water carrier business has got knobs on it. So
how many of you would go out together?
Oh, it varied from your platoon, which was 30-odd, to the company, which was 100-odd, and occasionally there'd be several times a year.
I assume in those days they were all men, were they?
Yes, and several times a year there'd be battalion exercise with 800 or 1,000 out there.
What's it like living with 30 or 100... other men at such close quarters?
Well, in the bush, you're fairly spread out.
Right.
The blokes operate mostly in pairs, and the platoon comprises, in those days, three sections of 10 men. They were commanded by a corporal, so your 30 blokes could be scattered over 300 or 400 square square metres depending on the terrain and the job to be done.
Mm. And how long did that last for?
I was there for 18 months.
18 months, and then?
Yeah. Then I
intelligence?
Yeah, went to the intelligence School of Military Intelligence, which was at Canungra.
Canungra, in Queensland, yeah. Just outside Brisbane there.
That's right, yeah.
Well, I had a few protests involved in Canungra. I think when you're in there, to be honest. So, so what was that like?
That was interesting.
Yeah, had you gone up in rank by then, or you're still a lieutenant?
No, I was still a lieutenant.
Yeah. So how long was that course?
It was about 2 months. And there are sort of other specialised courses you can do after that.
Yeah, I don't want you to divulge any secret. What is military intelligence?
Oh, that's the business of finding out as much and analysing as much information as possible about the enemy,
right,
whoever it is, or potential enemy. Yeah. Or if you're going into Timor, as we did later, then finding out about all the other stakeholders who might inadvertently get in the way, so you have to accommodate them, and refugees, all that sort of stuff. So the training was pretty thorough, I think.
2 months, that's a pretty short course.
It is, yeah.
And what did you do after that? What did that, once you finished that course and you graduated?
The first job was I was in charge of the counterintelligence section at the Divisional Intelligence Unit. Mm-hmm.
So what's counterintelligence?
That's when you're trying to deny your side's information to the enemy or the other side.
Right.
So it involves protecting the force against espionage, surveillance, sabotage, all those sorts of things.
How did you find that work?
It was all exercise stuff. We were thankfully in peace at the time, so there was a fair bit of training other units and going around and giving briefings and things like that. So the two interesting recollections out of that period were the School of Military Intelligence at the time was in this ramshackled old weatherboard house that had been there since goodness knows when. And we had this Foreign Officers Intelligence course came in. Of course, this was at the height of the anti-communist scare and all that sort of thing. And there was a chief instructor at the school, and one of the Asian students came after 3 weeks there, and he looked around and he looked at the chief instructor, and no names, no pack drill, but he said, "Oh, chief instructor, this is all very convincing, but where is the real SMI?"
This is the real SMI.
And then, by the time that course was wrapping up, I was sort of already assumed my post at the CI section in Anagra. And we got to give a briefing to these people when they came around, and I told them what we were doing, which wasn't much. Yeah. And one of them said, don't you go out and round up communists?
Yeah.
Which
you fools
we didn't, of course, and but he obviously was doubtful about the answer.
Yeah, well, you were remembering that, was it 1964-65 history in Indonesia?
Yes.
Fresh on their minds.
Yes.
Because Suharto would have still been dictator then, wouldn't he?
Exactly. Yeah. I'd recommend Josh Oppenheimer's film, The Act of Killing, to anyone that hasn't seen it.
Right, yeah. People don't understand it's one of the great mass killings of the 20th century.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. When they go on their Bali holidays, was it about 80,000 bodies still buried in any open space they can find?
That's right.
Mm. So you spoke about Timor. So the time between your encounter intelligence in Anagra and you were posted to Timor, what did you do?
Oh, there was a variety of jobs. Generally, you get posted every 2 years or so on, but I did some time in electronic warfare and other things. Probably the salient one was my posting to what was in the Joint Intelligence Organisation in Canberra, which is now the DIO.
Mm-hmm.
And some people go into the Indonesia trade, if you like, and they go to Langs and learn Bahasa.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get jobs in the embassy up there, or they sort of take that on as a speciality.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. And so those people sort of seek out jobs to do with Indonesia. But I just got posted there without lobbying for it or anything like that. So it came as a surprise. I was happy to do it.
Yeah.
The special study I picked up there was East Timor. There was So that was just a...
So you're one of the senior Australian Defence Forces personnel as far as intelligence on East Timor?
Oh, not senior, but I was sort of responsible for the low-level analysis of the stuff to do with the military and so on, and picking up Timor as a case study. And then it's funny how destiny works out, because I had... I can still remember the second time I heard the word Timor. Mm-hmm. And that was... I was on holidays down at Torquay at my maternal grandmother's place in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably about seven. And she was telling my mother about an ABC series on called Stormy Petrel, which was about these convicts that escaped by boat to Timor.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, full of knowledge as one is at seven, I piped up and said, "Oh, Timor, I've heard of that." The maternal grandmother was a very harsh old schoolmistress, so she turned around and snapped at me, "So you should have, it's right next to Australia."
That's right. Look, we'll let you get your breath. I'll just do station announcement. It's 4:32. This is Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. Empress Dale Bridge is doing all the important work, which allows you to listen to Lance Collins talk about his life and allows me to ask my impertinent questions. So, when do we get to Timor?
I'll just backtrack to this this business about it being right next to Australia. And I think the and this is to demonstrate how things just crop up in your life, into the circle of your life, if you like. Because I thought about it afterwards, and the first time I'd come across Timor, I think, was my parents had in the bookcase an old little cloth-bound pocketbook called The Observer's Book of Horses and Ponies. And that's long disappeared, but I do remember one page devoted to the Timor pony with an old grainy photo, black and white photo, and a location map. So I think that's where Timor entered my consciousness. And then, so I spent 2 years sort of looking at that when I was in, when I was at university was when the invasion happened, 75. So pretty conscious of what was going on and sort of taking note. And then I get posted to that desk and sort of had a daily diet of it for 2 years.
And what was the flow of information like? Was it reliable?
Oh, it was very political. And he was starting to delve into philosophy because, when we talk about at times now, we're looking at, in Australia anyway, the sort of overwhelming, almost religious-like belief in the American alliance and the market economy. And these have taken on the sort of values of religion. You know, they're just not to be challenged or anything.
It's the air we breathe.
And there's a fellow called Chris Beckworth. I'll just refresh myself on my notes here. He wrote a book called Empires of the Silk Road, in which he makes a few very interesting... We'll draw some interesting deductions about politicians in his study of 4,000 years of politics in Central Asia. But he points out that there can be two schools of thought, two ways of thinking, which are quite destructive. And one is the this religious belief in something, the matter of believing everything you're told, which leads to the suspension of disbelief. So you just become trusting in what your elders and betters take you. And the flip side of that is to be completely cynical, which is the suspension of disbelief and belief. And then he makes a point that both of these lead inexorably to a failure of the ability to think critically. So what you had in the intelligence system, you know, we wrote, Warren Reid and I, Warren Reid was an ex-ASIS officer, we wrote a book together called Plunging Point, which goes into... failures of intelligence to some degree. But so taking that as the basis, what happens when you get inside a bureaucratic organisation like that is that, and this is inculcated through intelligence training and doctrine as well, that you have reliable sources who can be trusted. And, of course, so they are the ones that come through official channels. So, you know, what the Indonesians tell our Indonesian official tells our official and through the diplomatic and military chains. and that comes through as from trusted sources and so on. The downside of it is that everything comes from that country's official sources, so it has an inbuilt bias and worldview and so on in it. By contrast, you had at the same time activists like Jill Jolliffe and so on who were putting out a very different story on what was going on in Timor and who was responsible and so on. And there was a fair bit of tension in the building about that.
Mm.
So I figured I was there to put together as much of the objective truth as I could, and that was where I had my first brush with officialdom because they weren't really interested in the
objective truth. Yeah. That's right.
So, the activists were dismissed as and ratbags and unreliable and emotive the usual plethora of terms. But I saw that they were, as far as I could tell, more accurate than officialdom.
Right.
So that was, I was glad to get out of there after a couple of years.
So what happened? What do you mean you got out of there? What did you do?
I was just posted on to a different job.
Right. Yeah. So did you go to Timor?
Not then.
Not at that stage.
No, I was supposed to have a liaison visit, familiarisation visit to Indonesia early in 1986.
Right.
Which was exactly when the David Jenkins affair broke out. Yeah. The Suharto family corruption and so on. So all bets were off there for a while. So I didn't get my familiarisation visit. But it lodged the Indonesian military and the whole Timor and West Papua thing firmly in my mind.
What do you mean the West Papua thing?
Oh, well, there were two special studies going on. One was East Timor and the other one was West Papua.
And you were involved in both of them in the 80s?
No, somebody else looked after the West Papua desk, but sat close to me, so I sort of picked up a bit of that by osmosis.
So what was the year that Australia went into East Timor?
The intervention was 1999.
So building up to that intervention, was there a lot of information flowing across your desk? Or?
By then I was working at General Cosgrove's headquarters in Brisbane.
Yep.
And we weren't directly engaged with it. We used to monitor what was coming in.
Right.
And I had a gut feeling that the current situation was going to give and there'd be a peacekeeping force there by Christmas. I was telling my people that to their concern by February 1999. But anyway, there was plenty of information coming in. And it was getting quite tense within the system because you had the same dual lines of thinking going on.
Yeah.
It was pretty clear from the media coverage and the activist organisations what the true situation was on the ground and who was behind it. And yet we had the government putting out this business, it's just a few rogue elements. And
that's right, yeah. So did you go to Timor at that stage? Or?
Yeah, I went in with the force in September 1999. I was in charge of coalition intelligence operations up there until...
Right. And what did you see when you got there?
Smoke, debris, terrified people, chaos. And I do have to say that was a good time to be Australian. The fact we went in and broke up what had been awful, despite Canberra's reluctance. And just the reaction of the Timorese to us was really quite humbling.
And how long did you spend there?
I got there in September 1999 and we left in February 2000. Well, as the UN, formal UN.
Right. Sort of by that time things had stabilised or still?
No, they'd stabilised.
So it's true. Is it true that people are saying 70-80% of everything had been destroyed?
A lot of it had.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Indonesians sort of burned the poorer areas, although a lot of them around at Bukhara and that survived. Just because they weren't burning, sort of bamboo shanty town, but they'd left a lot of their own administrative buildings intact for whatever reason.
So any lessons to be learnt? As far as your own job then as military intelligence, did you come away with any feelings when you came back about the job you were doing?
It was a very big experience. like the cattle camp was a big experience, and, the army itself was a big experience, and this was another one, another big experience. And just the brilliance of the people working around me was, you know, how hard they tried, and how much ordinary, you know, humanitarian sympathy they had for the Timorese was really something to behold. The so that part of it was good. The trouble really started when I got back, and
what trouble?
I was warned as pretty much as soon as I hit hit terra firma in Australia that the knives were out for me in Canberra. So.
Why would the knives? You did a good job. Why would the knives be out for you?
Well, that's why.
Because you did a good job. Yeah. Hopefully, you did. Yeah, hopefully you'd gone up from lieutenant by then.
That's right. I was lieutenant colonel at that stage.
Yeah, so they would.
So while this was going on, unbeknownst to us, was you know, the whole Timor Gap sort of renegotiation where we had a treaty with Indonesia, and now that was sort of. Defaulted by the change of sovereignty and so on. So the stuff you've heard recently about, you know, the ASIS bugging Timorese officers and then ASIO under the same bloke years later raiding the offices of Bernard Collieri too.
They weren't suggesting you were a fifth columnist, were they? I mean, it seems strange. Yeah. You've done a good job. You come back, you're a lieutenant colonel, you spent, what, 20 years in the army, probably?
Yeah.
You know, you spent most of your adult life there, and the knives are out for you.
That's right. It was the system protecting itself.
Right. Yeah.
And behind that, you know, you say you had the officialdom protecting itself and its reputation and... And... They had a view they were the experts when they'd been getting it wrong for 20 years, and there were bizarre assessments coming out of Canberra, like in early 1999 when the violence was at its height. There was, and this one was leaked by somebody, but it's in Des Ball's book, Silent Witness, where one of the assessments coming out of one of the Canberra agencies was, oh, paradoxically, the TNI acts as a balancing force. So... they're actually keeping a lid on the violence when...
So in many ways, people like you, the small number of people like you in the armed forces, especially in terms of that time, were basically a reminder to them they got it wrong, and they got it badly wrong.
That's right, and there were special interests at stake, as there's Paul Cleary's book, Shakedown, which traces, you know, the whole malarkey about when Canberra realised, or when the corporate Canberra realised that... the old treaty with Indonesia was now having to be renegotiated, and they were off to see Shinano Gusmo very quickly to renegotiate a favourable treaty for corporations. Then all that was going on behind the scenes. So when I came back and started saying there needed to be a royal commission, it's how bad the intelligence was overall, then obviously they didn't want a royal commission that might expose that sort of stuff.
So how long did you last in the army before you were shown the door?
So I got back in February 2000, in September 2000, cunningly timed with the first day of the Olympics when no one would notice it, the Sydney Olympics.
Wow.
I was named on a federal police warrant that was served on a few other people around Canberra.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Clinton Fernandez, who's now a professor at ADFA, was one of them. And I was actually on a few days' leave at the time, and he finally managed to get me on the phone, and he said... he was trying to find out how I was and where I was, and he'd been raided. You know, the federal police and some defence security people came in and woke him up, and he says the first thing he saw was a pistol being put away back in a briefcase, which is they deny it, but it was and someone else, an ex Air Force fellow, was he and his wife were. Kept in separate rooms all day while they searched the house and so on. And so some people have had very long-term psychological ill effects out of this.
So this is the army eating its own?
Not so much the army as...
the political...
Yeah, the villains were the Defence Security Branch, Foreign Affairs.
So what did they get out of these warrants? What happened? Were there any charges laid?
Nothing was ever found. No charges were laid. They so it was designed to wreck people's career. There's no punishment in it.
Yeah,
and warning to everybody
suspect,
else.
Yeah.
So earlier, of course, they Merv Jenkins, with whom I'd worked in one of my early appointments, he left the Army and joined the Defence Intelligence Organisation at a fairly senior level, and he was our liaison man in Washington with their Defence Intelligence Agency. And earlier that year, June 1999, he was found hanged in Washington after a visit from this same defence security outfit with foreign affairs security people in there. And they threatened him with jail, and he was found hanged the next morning.
So what happened to you?
I learned this news. You know, my wife rang me up and said, "Oh, have you seen the Sydney Morning Herald today?" And I said, "No, I'm in country Melbourne, country Victoria." And she said, "Well, you're all over it, you know." So,
public enemy number
that's
one.
That's right. So, and then you sort of wait for a while to see what happens, and nothing did. And the general said, "I'll keep your head down." But I then submitted a redress of grievance, looking for some way to lob a grenade back. Anyway, I wrote to Minister Moore first, saying they're, bad things were afoot. And he then sent it to the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, who initiated a cover-up that went on for, about 4 years. And after several years, I'd heard nothing, so I initiated a second inquiry by the defence system, and I asked that that an investigating officer would be appointed, and I asked that it not be from the Army. And the fellow who showed up was Captain Martin Toohey of the Royal Australian Naval Reserve, who's one of the gutsiest Australians I've met, and I've met a few. Anyway, he took on this thing, and where the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, which is a cul-de-sac where they see problems to be disposed of. Toohey finished his report within a few months and handed it in, and then there was a great big nothing. And 6 months went by, and that's when I wrote to John Howard saying, this has been going on and you need a Royal Commission into your intelligence system. And then all hell broke loose, basically. So
what do you mean all hell broke loose?
I was warned not to speak to the media, and you're sort of put into a sort of Coventry without any sort of official or public statements made about it.
So when did you leave the armed forces?
About a year later.
Was that 2007?
2005.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I actually had a complaint with the Inspector General of Intelligence, because we had the Abbott, when he was Health Minister, he leaked. He actually gave our intelligence records, a number of us involved in a Defend and Extend Medicare campaign, to the Herald Sun.
Right.
And we made the official complaints, and as you said, nothing ever comes out of it. It's just shunted aside. So what did you do after you left the Army? You didn't become a novelist like your mother wanted you to be.
I did, in a way. In fact, I'd started a novel on this Byzantine medieval Armenian theme.
What? Byzantinian Armenian thing. What's that?
Oh, it was when it's a true story, which I stumbled over in JFC Fuller's Decisive Battles of the Western World, which is a ripping good history read. And he's talking about the beginnings of the collapse of Byzantium and the first inroads by the Seljuk Turks into Armenia, which was then Byzantine, reluctant Byzantine provinces on their eastern frontier. And the first big invasion was in 1054, the year that the Catholic and Orthodox churches split. And it was done in some strength with the evident intent of permanently occupying the area. So the raid lasted for about 6 weeks and something like, or 2 months, 130,000 people were killed, according to Gibbon's estimate, which is probably the most reliable. And the Turks came in. They evidently achieved tactical surprise. They took two cities and then came to a city called Manzikert, which was one of the most eminent cities in southern Armenia. And they besieged that. And the garrison held out for a month against all odds. It was a really multicultural battle on the inside, trying to stay alive. You had the local Armenians the Byzantines, who were Greeks that called themselves Romans, the Eastern Roman Empire, Frankish mercenaries, people called variously Varangian and Rus, so they were from, they were Scandinavian and Russian mercenaries from north of the Black Sea, because the Vikings by then had established a trading post at Kiev, and their intermarriage with the locals produced the Rus, which was the forerunner of Russian civilization, actually. And on the outside trying to get in, you had Turks, Kurds, Arabs, you know, Persians, everybody. So towards the end of the siege, the Turks dragged up this enormous great siege engine, which could smash a hole in the wall. And it would have meant the end for everybody, because if a city resisted, then it was put to the sword. And one of the surrender terms would be surrender your city and hand over your fairest daughter as a bride for the Sultan. So, you know, it gets to this decisive moment in the siege where this this game-changing engine appears outside the walls, and the governor asked for somebody to go and take it out. And this Frankish mercenary stepped forward. And the deal was, if you killed in the attempt, which is just about certain, then all the rich rewards that would be coming would go to your wife and children. You know, this Frankish mercenary stepped forward and said, and his words have been recorded by medieval priests and so on, I'll do it, and today my blood will be shed for all the Christians, and I have no wife or children to worry about me. So out he went into this suicidal thing on a horse he was given, and he got away with it. He wrecked the engine and got back inside the walls, and the Turks were so disgusted they gave away the siege and went home.
So why would you spend all this time researching this?
Things cross your path. It struck me as a ripping yarn, because from the time of seeing Ben-Hur back in Western District in the 60s, I'd been interested in Rome, and that leads to Byzantium. And then once you start studying the Byzantine frontier, then you start to collide with the histories of the Armenians and the Kurds. And it grows.
We're running out of time, so I'm just going to jump a few years. You've been involved with the West Papuan movement, the independence movement, for some time. Why?
That's another injustice, which Australia has been a party to, the same as we were a party to the Timor injustice. So that's why. You know, that's why. It's just unjust,
You know, at your age, shouldn't you be retired, looking after the grandkids?
No, I don't have children.
Right. Oh, well, they don't wonder you're writing
simple,
books.
There's a reason for that. I know what I did to my father, and I always swore I'd never give anyone the chance to do it to me. It's just one of those running sores in Australia that
Needs to be resolved.
That needs a band-aid,
So I understand you're speaking on the 13th of December. That's this Sunday.
That's right.
Yeah. So what are you speaking about?
The novel I've written is about to be published. It's not out yet. Yep. So there'll be people speaking about that. But the things I want to touch on basically are some of the constant themes that come through history. And you've got the Armenian genocide on one hand, which is sort of runs parallel with what's been going in West Papua with the death toll there. And there are certain commonalities, people looking the other way, the fate of small nations jammed between the interests of great powers. But for medieval Armenia, it was Byzantium and the Turks after the Arabs. And for West Papua, of course, it's American interests in Indonesia and Australia.
So I understand Bishop Deakin is launching the book?
That's right, yes.
Now, all our listeners are very lucky, because not only are we having a book launch, we're having the West Papuan Rent Collective end-of-year break.
That's right.
Midday to 4 p.m. It's at the Australian Catholic University Art Gallery, because the West Papuan Independence Movement's got an art exhibition on simultaneously. They've got activities going on all week. And that's at 26 Brunswick Street in Fitzroy. So it's midday. So there's lots of traditional food being served. Great speakers like yourself, Lance.
What date was that again?
This Sunday, the 13th, midday to 4 p.m. Couldn't be any better. I've heard Lance speak, and he's quite passionate for a retired army bloke. Very passionate.
I might mention at the art gallery, there's a very good exhibition of West Papuan paintings and artefacts that are worth a look at too.
So. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we fought, and the thing is, since they've had their office in Collins Street, I think it's made a difference to,
yes,
to their profile. And all those people who want to be part of the West Papuan Rent Collective, try before you buy and just come along to the breakup. Easy. Listen to Lance, listen to Bishop Dickin, meet some of the activists, look at the art, enjoy the three food. What else do people want? I don't know.
It's a dream.
Well, Lance, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. You can never do justice in an hour. Now, if you do publish another book, maybe we'll get you in for an hour and actually just look at this concept that you're talking about at some stage next year about, you know, what happens to small countries in between great empires, because that parallel you draw between the Armenians and the West Papuans is a very real parallel. You can see it in Kurdistan, you see it everywhere.
Oh, you see it with us now.
Yeah.
Jammed between the Chinese and the Americans. So.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Interesting times.
Maybe we will have to do something. Well, thank you, Dale Bridge, for doing all the work today. Thank you, Lance Collins, for allowing us to look into your life. And hopefully a few hundred of our listeners will turn up on the Sunday, on the 26th of at the 26 Brunswick Street in Fitzroy, the Australian Catholic University Art Gallery. Relax, there's no religion involved, okay? Unless Jacob's brother does a prayer, which I'm sure he'll do. Thank you very much, Lance.
Thank you.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows. Like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful. Give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet, but there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes.